Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Has the war on terror fundamentally changed America and its core values? Since the attacks of September 11, 2001, the U.S. has spent hundreds of billions of dollars on homeland security and overseas military and paramilitary campaigns. The total sum of money spent is remarkable on its own. But perhaps more concerning is the amount wasted, scammed, and stolen over the past 13 years, with those responsible for the losses rarely held to account. Meanwhile, the Homeland Security industrial complex hums along, with functions from domestic data collection to targeted drone killings continuing unabated. James Risen is an investigative reporter with the New York Times. His new book is called Pay Any Price: Greed, Power, and Endless War. James, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So we have this hunt for terrorists going on within the United States and particularly around the world. It seems that there are also a lot of people hunting for money. It's a cash grab.
Yeah, I think what if you look back at 9/11, you know, right after 9/11, we as a country started, I guess, what you might call a search for justice or retribution, however you want to say what we were doing right after 9/11. And today it's really 13 years later, it's a search for cash or power or status. And I think we've never gone through a period as long as this in our history of continuous war. And it warps a society to have, continuous war. And throughout history, if you look at the Roman Empire or European countries in the Middle Ages, the extended war over this long of a prolonged period has really warps a society. You create a mercenary class, and that's what I think we've created.
So in the days following 9/11, our chief goal would have been to get Osama bin Laden. Right now, it's been 3.5 years since U.S. forces killed him. What kinds of reassessments have we seen since then of national security strategy and expenditures?
Well, we haven't really seen much of anything. President Obama and some of his aides have given speeches about how there's a need to eventually end the war on terror, but he never has done anything about it. In fact, Obama really extended and continued almost all of the policies, counterterrorism policies of President Bush. And I think one of the real legacies of the Obama administration is going to be sort of counterintuitive. No one wants to think of it this way, but what he really has done is normalize the war on terror. He's made the policies that Bush and Cheney started in an ad hoc way right after 9/11. He's put them on bipartisan footing and made them permanent. And so now there's very few people in Washington of either party who have any great interest in criticizing the war on terror. And except for libertarians among Republicans and kind of very liberal people in the Democratic Party. And so the mainstream political view in Washington is to continue to pour money into the war on terror without asking very many questions about what's really going on.
You have a really eloquent line in the book, and that is that executive power, once accumulated, is a hard thing to give up, and Obama quickly succumbed. Do you think, I mean, this is speculative, but do you think that would have been the case for anyone who had sat in the Oval Office in the administration that followed the George W. Bush administration?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I think Obama in 2008 ran as the anti-Bush candidate, and a lot of people voted for him because of their anger over the Iraq War or other Bush policies. And I think that he had an opportunity to make a break with the war on terror. I think, in my own opinion, I think what happened in part, I think there were a lot of different factors that weighed into what he did. But I think part of it was that the economy was so bad, he decided to, when he took office, that he decided to focus on domestic policy, on the economy, and on his healthcare initiative. And he decided he didn't really want to have a big fight with Republicans on national security, I think. you saw that immediately after he took office when he signed an executive order, you know, closing Guantanamo. And then when protests in Congress happened against that policy, he backed off and didn't pursue anything along those lines in the future.
The complexity of these operations for national security or in the name of national security might have kept many people from sort of keeping tabs on where all the money's going and how it's being spent. You have been paying close attention. First of all, how accessible is this information to the public about how much is being spent overall and where it goes?
It's not easy to figure out. And that's one of the problems, is that in addition to having massive amounts of money pour into this, that's layered on underneath the whole veil of secrecy that the government has maintained on the whole war on terror. If you look back to 9/11, virtually everything we now know about the conduct of the war on terror has been classified. It's really the first war in American history. If you count all, you know, if you lump together Afghanistan, Iraq, and the broader global war on terror, virtually everything has been, this is the first war in our history where everything has been classified. And most of what we now know about what's happened has been through the press or, leaks in various ways. And very little has been, publicly and officially released or voluntarily released by the White House. And so we have basically a massive spigot that's been turned open, and nobody's been watching to see where it's going and what's happening with it.
There are a number of scenes in the book that read more like something out of a thriller or a movie than reality, although this is a work of nonfiction. Why was at least $12 billion in $100 bills shipped from New Jersey to Baghdad on pallets?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite stories. Right after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the Bush administration began to airlift $100 bills to Iraq in massive numbers, between $12 and $14 billion in cash.
What could go wrong?
Yeah, it was taken from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York's East Rutherford, New Jersey currency facility, which is kind of like the Fort Knox of cash in the United States. And it was trucked from there to Andrews Air Force Base and then loaded onto C-17 transports and flown to Iraq through either Kuwait or Germany. Then was met by a caravan of at Baghdad International Airport, and then driven in convoys to the Green Zone or to the Iraqi Central Bank. And after it arrived in either the Green Zone or the Central Bank, pretty much nobody knows what happened to it. And at least $11.7 billion is unaccounted for. And what I found was that U.S. investigators who had been tracking this money finally found that almost $2 billion had been stolen and moved to a bunker in Lebanon where it was being hidden. And there was this huge numbers of pallets of $100 bills sitting in this bunker in Lebanon being hidden by the people who had stolen it after it arrived from the United States.
Okay, so we have that information in hand, but then nobody goes after the cash.
Right, yeah. The Special Inspector General for Iraq, Stuart Bowen, who was appointed by the Bush administration, kind of became fixated in finding this money, and he eventually tracked it down to this bunker in Lebanon and realized that it had been stolen by very powerful Iraqi officials and that they were probably in league with some Lebanese money launderers who were protecting it. But he couldn't find anybody else in the U.S. government who cared enough to go do anything about it. He talked to the CIA and the FBI and the State Department, and sent a couple investigators to Beirut to meet with Lebanese prosecutors, who promised at first that they would conduct a raid and never did. And the CIA and the FBI both told him they weren't interested in getting involved. He also met with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki of Iraq, and Maliki made it clear to Bowen that he knew about the bunker and was angry at the way the U.S. had handled the money in the airlift. But Maliki's government didn't go after it either, and it seems like nobody wants to know the answer of who took the money and, you know, who was behind this massive theft. It's probably the largest robbery in modern history.
So, I mean, I'm discouraged from sending cash, you know, with my kids in an envelope for a school bake sale or a fundraiser because there are concerns about money being lost, misappropriation, whatever you want to call it. To be clear here, there was a reason that might have seemed rational, and that was people wanted to be able to put this money to use right away and cut through red tape. Was that the justification as you understand it?
Yeah, more or less. This was mostly from what was called the Development Fund for Iraq. It was money generated by Iraqi oil sales beginning right after the invasion of Iraq. And it was held by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And the Coalition Provisional Authority, which was the U.S.-led occupation government in the first year after the invasion, said that they wanted the money to jumpstart the new Iraqi government and help put a cash infusion into the Iraqi economy. But they did it in a way that really there were no rules, virtually no regulations or oversight. And since it was Iraqi government cash and not U.S. taxpayer funds, nobody in Washington really seemed to care much about what happened to it. So that was just loaded onto planes and shipped over there. And basically nobody checked up on it afterwards. There was one part of it, a little over $1 billion went to the Kurds, to Kurdistan. And Stuart Bowen and his investigators found that the CPA had flown this cash to Kurdistan on Chinook helicopters, and they arrived at the Erbil branch of the Iraqi Central Bank, and nobody was expecting it. They didn't know what to do with it, and they just stuck the pallets of $100 bills in the bank until they could make some calls about what to do with it. And then some Americans later called back and just to make sure that, you know, it was being taken care of, and they said, oh, yeah, fine, everything's fine. We've taken care of that cash. So,
any evidence that U.S. personnel were skimming funds?
Not in the airlift itself. There were lots of other Americans who were charged with skimming money from what was widely known in Iraq as SERP funds. That was a separate amount of cash, which was a lot of cash. The SERP fund was the commander's funds that U.S. Army gave to individual commanders all over Iraq to use as they saw fit, often to help with local reconstruction projects or to pay off local leaders to make sure they didn't join the insurgency or that they switched sides. And I tell a story in the book about how a lot of that money, you know, ended up in the rucksacks and knapsacks of American officers who came home, and then they were found out after they arrived home.
My guest is James Risen. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times and author of the new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with New York Times investigative journalist James Risen, author of the new book Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think at kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. James, we have experienced high levels of anxiety since 9/11 over the capabilities of our terrorist enemies, which at times seems to have caused us to grasp at straws in trying to outfox them. Tell us a little bit about Dennis Montgomery and the product that he convinced the CIA that he could deliver.
Yeah, Dennis Montgomery is straight out of central casting, I think. He's one of my favorite stories of the whole war on terror. Dennis Montgomery was a computer software expert, supposed expert, who convinced the CIA that he had a super secret computer technology that could detect secret Al-Qaeda codes hidden away in Al Jazeera news, network news broadcasts. And for a few months in 2003, the CIA took his supposed technology so seriously that they convinced President Bush to ground a whole series of international flights that were coming to the United States based on what Montgomery claimed were numbers and letters that only he could see hidden in Al Jazeera news, the banner on Al Jazeera news network news broadcasts. And he convinced the CIA that he had this ability to see hidden hidden images in videotape that no one else could see. And for a time, the CIA considered this the number one super secret source they had on Al-Qaeda. And it took, after they grounded flights in right before Christmas in 2003, they then had a meeting at the White House where they even talked about shooting down these flights if they came over the Atlantic. And some of the flights were from France, from Paris. One of the flights grounded, I think, was Paris to Los Angeles. And so the French intelligence service didn't think this was very funny. And they demanded to know what the source of this information was from the CIA. And CIA finally told them, and they had a French high-tech firm reverse engineer what this technology was supposed to be, and they realized it was a fabrication, and that there were no hidden messages in these Al Jazeera broadcasts. But after the CIA realized that this was all a hoax, they just covered the whole thing up and didn't do anything about it.
Were Montgomery's champions within the CIA fully aware of his background?
That's a good question. They refused to talk about this in any detail. He had been trying to sell this kind of technology, first to Hollywood, where he said that it would be useful for colorizing old movies, because if you could detect images in videotape, it would make it really easy, I guess, the thinking went to colorize movies. And then when that, he didn't get much interest from Hollywood, then he went to Las Vegas and tried to convince the casinos that he had the ability to detect cheating in a way that the casinos hadn't been able to do yet. One of the things he said he could do was through his videotape technology, he could detect a large value chip inside a pile of regular chips on videotape. The casinos didn't go along with it either. But at a casino, he met a wealthy investor who he convinced to go along with him and fund his company. And then he met some military officers at a casino who he convinced to try out his technology. And through both the military and his investors and their political allies, he got in with the CIA. And the CIA at that moment, I think, was so anxious to find some answer to Al-Qaeda that they went along with it. They wanted to believe that there was a silver bullet. and that Dennis Montgomery had it.
Is it a fact that Al-Qaeda was using Al Jazeera on a regular basis to transmit coded messages?
No, no. I mean, the reason, you know, the Bush administration kind of became obsessed with Al Jazeera.
Oh, Al Jazeera, yeah, excuse me.
Yeah, because you know, bin Laden would send them videotapes of statements that he would make. And they were also very critical. Their news coverage was very critical of the war in Iraq. And so they were kind of already on the, you know, they were an organization that the Bush administration hated to begin with. And so this idea that there were these hidden embedded messages in Al Jazeera newscasts kind of hit, you know, resonated with the Bush administration. It was as if, you know, Montgomery knew what they wanted to hear.
So what happens to a guy like Montgomery who pulls over this amazing scam on the Central Intelligence Agency?
Well, he got more contracts. He kept getting more contracts with the military. After the CIA says that they kind of stopped working with him, he kept getting contracts with the Air Force and the Special Operations Command and a whole bunch of other military organizations, and by 2009 was still involved enough with the military that there's some evidence that he was involved with a with the efforts to uncover a supposed threat to the Obama's inauguration from Somali terrorists, which turned out to be a fabrication and a hoax. There was no threat by Somali terrorists to the inauguration. But there's some email traffic showing that that Montgomery was thanked by people in the government for helping uncover or detect that threat.
To what extent have private defense contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan outnumbered military boots on the ground in those campaigns?
Well, that's been, you know, in Iraq and in Afghanistan, we've had more contractors at the height of the U.S. involvement. We had more contractors in Iraq than we had troops. KBR, the one, the biggest basic services company that had a huge, the largest defense contract in Iraq. I think that at their height of involvement in Iraq, they had more personnel in Iraq than the British Army did. So, you know, that for one single company. So it's the problems with outsourcing are just part of just one symptom in a much larger problem in the war on terror, which was that, you know, after 9/11, when Dick Cheney said, you know, the gloves come off, what that really meant was we were deregulating national security. We were taking all the old rules on national security off that had been put in place in the 1970s after Watergate and the intelligence abuses that were revealed by the Church Committee. And under the Bush administration, we began to ignore those rules or skirt those rules, and we created a whole new national security state. And it was a deregulated national security state. And at the same time we took off the rules, we poured all this money into it. And it created kind of what I would call a national security crisis, kind of like the banking crisis. This huge, huge enterprise with very few rules or regulations or oversight in which we were pouring hundreds of billions of dollars. It's a lot like the subprime mortgage market. And we had a lot of the same kind of consequences. It's just that no one has stopped to look at it in the same way we looked at the banking crisis.
What's interesting is that typically in this country, when we look to privatize something that was previously handled by government, one of the main arguments is that we will somehow save money.
Right, right. Well, the problem is that, you know, we made it clear that right after 9/11 that we were going to pour this massive amount of money into counterterrorism, and that we were going to have, I think, you know, a zero tolerance for any terrorist attack in the United States, which means we would have to create a massive new counterterrorism infrastructure. And that was like, you know, there were a lot of people who began to realize that this was, you know, if you wanted to get rich in America, all you had to do was go to Washington and claim to be a counterterrorism expert. The CIA, the FBI, the Pentagon, all these agencies had more money to spend than they knew what to do with. And there were no, very few rules on what they had to do to spend it or to, you know, or how to conduct their, these activities. So it was really like the Wild West. And we've, you know, kind of had a lot of unintended consequences as a result.
Does outsourcing basic support services of the on-the-ground military presence in a foreign military conflict, does that actually sort of raise the possibility that any uniformed U.S. personnel are likely to be injured in war? Do you understand what I'm saying? There are fewer people working for the Army peeling potatoes mm-hmm. and more of them out on the front
right.
lines.
Well, what it does is it makes it possible for the United States to go to war without a draft. We were able to conduct the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan with far fewer troops than we would have if we didn't have outside contractors. What that means is politically you don't have to have a debate about the war. You can have a volunteer army and you don't have to, you know, increase the size of the war of the army at times of war, because you can use KBR or other companies to provide all the basic services when, you know, for the time of the deployment, instead of having a draft that would be politically difficult for the country, because then you'd have to actually debate whether or not we should be going to war.
Tell us a little bit about the outsourcing of intelligence gathering to private contractors.
Well, that's become, you know, one of the things that is really difficult to see out, you know, as an outsider, is this growth of the what I call the Homeland Security Industrial Complex, or the military industrial complex, where these large weapons systems manufacturers. During the Cold War, and they would be, you know, you could see what they were building. They were building jets or submarines or missiles, and there would be big public debates about whether or not we should be doing that. But the Homeland Security Industrial Complex is really built around smaller contractors who actually just provide secret information or conduct intelligence operations that no one sees and no one knows about. And as a result, you've got all these little companies that with weird names that nobody hears about, and then they shift and change their names almost overnight as one contractor or another comes and goes. And they are essentially performing inherently governmental functions for the CIA or the FBI or other agencies. And they're going out in the field and gathering intelligence rather than building weapons. So they're doing essentially the same thing that we thought we had the CIA for, or the Pentagon. And in many of these cases, they are, you know, no one knows they are out there doing that. And yet they're performing these very sensitive functions with very little oversight. You know, they're getting secret contracts. All of their work is classified, so no one knows that these exist.
And it may not be open to the same channels of declassification down the road for, say, historians to study.
Right. Yeah, and there's very little congressional oversight of contractors either, because the oversight committee, the intelligence oversight committees, basically just look at the work of the CIA or the NSA or, you know, the Armed Services Committee looks at the Pentagon. They don't have the same ability to check up on contractors. And when really the only big congressional hearings that have been held in this area are like with Blackwater, and that was only after Blackwater was involved with, you know, their guards were involved with shooting civilians in Iraq. So it's unless something like that blows up, it's difficult for anyone to get a handle on what these contractors are really doing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jackie in Dallas. Hello, Jackie.
Good day. Thank you. Yes, I have a question, comment. Of course, World War II, Japan had no oil. I'm sorry that the energy oil people imposed all of this on our country and the world. Now, my question is, the Iraq invasion of Kuwait, has the author traced back this money trail actually starting prior to the Iraq invasion of Kuwait? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I guess, you know, a lot of people now talk about the U.S. presence in Iraq as really a 25-year period. You know, we've had, I think, four different presidencies now have been involved with military operations of one form or another in Iraq, going back to the first Bush president. And so it's, you know, it's difficult to nowadays, if you look back at our history in Iraq, it's almost like one long war there, going back to the first Gulf War.
Is it possible to say, since a lot of this, the intelligence that's been gathered has been done sort of under the table, can we compare the quality of what outside contractors are getting as compared to those who are officially employed by the U.S. government?
Well, you know, it varies. In some cases, what's happening is that CIA officers realize that the quickest way to get rich is just to quit and then come back the next week as a contractor doing the same job. So it's not always different people. So it really varies.
My guest is James Risen, investigative reporter with the New York Times and author of the new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New York Times investigative reporter James Risen, author of the new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we find Jeff in Denton. Hello, Jeff. Jeff, are you with us?
Hi, yes.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I was just wondering, hearing all these negative things about the private security contractors and the lack of oversight in this area, were there any benefits that were gained from any kind of intelligence, or like, were they doing their job that they were there for?
Well, the ones I focused on in my book are some of the ones that provided the weirdest and most humorous stories. I'm sure there's some that did a good job. But I think that in large part what I tried to show in the book is that there is a when you take the rules off of the war on terror and you say that we can conduct national security with virtually no oversight, that it's very difficult to ever tell anyone, you know, trying – determine how you're going to make this work in the long term, because you're creating this whole new mercenary class, as I said before, people whose main job is to find ways to make sure the war on terror continues so they can continue to make money. And so they have an incentive to provide information that shows that there's always a threat.
I want to talk about NSA practices of harvesting private digital data without authorization. First of all, the amount of information stored online has grown exponentially over the past decade as we all just keep more there. The NSA has been sort of right there to watch silently over our shoulders as we upload it all. But years before the Edward Snowden affair, a House Intelligence Committee staffer tried to sound some alarm bells. Can you tell us what happened to her?
Yeah, Diane Rourke was the House Intelligence Committee's staffer overseeing the NSA at the time of 9/11. And in my book, I describe how right after 9/11, she was told by some people at the NSA that the NSA was starting to spy on Americans. And this was a major change in the way the NSA operated. In the past, it had been limited only to conduct foreign intelligence, foreign eavesdropping. But now it was secretly conducting spying on Americans without any court approval. And so she began to try to stop it. She went to her bosses in Congress, and she went to the White House. She went to judges, and she finally went directly to the director of the NSA and had a very dramatic showdown with Michael Hayden, who was then the NSA director. And he told her that, you know, after she said to him, "I think what you're doing is illegal," he told her, "Well, if it ever comes out, we'll have the majority of nine," meaning we'll have the Supreme Court on our side. And so she then, as one last gasp, tried to get to Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist to warn him about the program, but she couldn't get to him, and she retired. And then after several years, she was retired, and our stories in the New York Times came out disclosing the existence of this program, and the FBI and the Justice Department and the NSA immediately suspected her as having leaked, and so they raided her house and turned her life upside down, even though she had never talked to the press.
What about the protections that are supposedly in place to keep whistleblowers from who are legitimately reporting things that are illegal from prosecution or persecution?
Well, that was the great problem in her case, is that she did it the right way. She stayed inside the government, tried to stop what she believed and what many other people believed was an illegal operation. And she was punished for her efforts, even though she never leaked to the press. And so I tell her story for the first time in the book as a way to show this is her story is like a case study of why Edward Snowden could not have stayed in the government and worked through channels and do what he eventually did. He would have been arrested immediately.
You, as many people are aware, have been in hot water over your refusal to testify in the criminal trial of a former CIA analyst alleged to have leaked classified information to you. Can you explain why you've resisted that and why you believe you were dragged into that case in the first place?
Well, I can't comment on the specifics of the case, but I can just say in general, reporters, investigative reporting can't be conducted without confidential sources. And this country, I don't believe, would maintain its democracy without an aggressive investigative reporting, because that's the only way that real oversight of the government can be conducted by the press. And so I think if we can't, continue to provide the confidentiality or the promise of confidentiality as journalists, the press freedom will seriously be eroded in the United States.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Mike in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I have a question. Everyone speculated why Bush actually specifically pulled the trigger, and no pun intended, to go to Iraq. And no one seems to give a very definitive answer. It all seems very fuzzy. So my question is, have you come up with something you think is pretty definitive as to why, what motivated George Bush precisely to go? And also, how much was Saddam Hussein as an irritant and as a threat to Israel a motivating factor? Because you never hear that mentioned either. So I'm just curious if you can shed any more specific light on this subject that everyone seems to speculate about, but no one has a much concrete feeling about what precisely motivated George Bush.
That's a great question. It's one of the questions historians, I think, are going to be continuing to study for decades. I think, in my opinion, and from what I know of doing a lot of research in this area, I think there were a number of factors. First of all, there were a lot of people around Bush who had been wanting to go into Iraq during the 1990s, and they were critical of the Clinton administration's handling of Iraq policy even before they came back into office. And there were also, a number of people in the Pentagon who I think after 9/11 and after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan believed that they needed a more, that Afghanistan wasn't a very big war. It was a very tiny little operation by comparison to Iraq. And I think there was a sense that the United States needed to demonstrate its power in the heart of the Middle East to make a statement against jihadism. I think there's a lot of different factors, and it's one of the most difficult things in recent history to unwrap all, which factors were the most important.
How does technology acquisition work in the Pentagon? In other words, how do military leaders learn that some private company is developing a new drone that might be the best drone ever and the most effective? And to what extent is that, does that really shape the plans that the Pentagon makes for purchasing and then actually using this technology?
Well, it depends. They have a highly regulated, or traditionally the Pentagon has had a highly regulated, highly bureaucratic acquisition and contracting system that takes years and years for new weapon systems to be developed. And it's done jointly between, the experts inside the military and the large contractors. But what happened in some of the cases in the war on terror was that immediately after 9/11 and with the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, you saw that whole process short-circuited on a number of ways, particularly on, as I said, on these intelligence contractors. And some things like the armed drone, the armed Predator, which had been in development stage for quite a while, but had never been deployed, suddenly they deployed it in Afghanistan after there had been debates for years, both at the CIA and the Pentagon about it. So war will, during peacetime, the contracting process is very prolonged. War tends to short-circuit that process.
We've heard that the Obama administration has expanded the use of drones for targeted killings of suspected terrorists abroad. To what extent have they expanded that use?
Dramatically. I mean, that's one of the programs that really is a signature of Barack Obama. Bush started the use of drones in Afghanistan and to some extent in Iraq and Pakistan. But when Obama came in, it was, to him, it seemed to be the silver bullet that would allow counterterrorism programs without as many boots on the ground in the Middle East. And I think that was the way he saw the drone program. I could continue to target al-Qaeda leaders without having the big military forces in the region. And so he dramatically accelerated the use of drones, the use of airstrikes and night raids by special operations forces in both Afghanistan and Pakistan and elsewhere. I mean, Pakistan was drones. But so it's a... I forget the numbers, but the numbers that some of the individual groups keep show just a really remarkable increase in drone strikes under Obama.
And these days, the Air Force is actually training more individuals to control unmanned drones than to pilot actual aircraft.
Yeah, that was a massive, that was a major cultural shift within the Air Force, because it used to be that in order to get ahead in the Air Force, you had to be a pilot. Now squadrons are being switched over from manned aircraft to drones, and the pilots are just guys who sit behind, you know, sit at a desk with a you know, control system. So it's a real cultural shift. And it's there's also a big bureaucratic fight between the CIA and the Air Force for control over drones. Obama was in the process of turning drone the control over drone all drone operations to the Air Force, but then the CIA fought back, and so right now there's kind of a stalemate between the Air Force and the CIA. Both still are involved in drone strikes, and neither one wants to give up. All give up their operations.
There was a story last week about the French government trying to figure out who was using drones to observe its nuclear power plants. Are we simply assuming that our enemies won't get their hands on drone technology and attempt to use it against us?
Well, it's a very simple technology, and it's already being spread. And I think that's one of the problems with our use of it. We have set an example for other countries that we, you know, you can basically conduct drone strikes wherever you feel like. Since we've now used it in several countries, and so I think it's just a matter of time before virtually every country in the world has drones. They're very cheap, and the technology is not very advanced.
Where do you think we are headed? Do you feel like reporting like this will have a significant impact on the kinds of choices made within the military about spending?
I don't know. I think the basic problem for our country is that until we as Americans begin to become more skeptical of the fear-mongering on the war on terror and don't fall for every new threat alert that either the government or cable news puts out, and don't panic all the time. There's going to be, until we get to that point where we're more skeptical, you know, it's going to be easy for politicians to continue to say, well, we've got to pour more money into this. We've got to do whatever's necessary. We've got to have new restrictions on civil liberties because that's what keeps us safe. And that's a dangerous place, I think, politically. Right now, politicians know that if they had just have to show that they're not soft on terrorism in order to get elected, and that means they're always going to be willing to do more on to spend more.
James Risen is an investigative reporter with the New York Times. His new book is called Pay Any Price: Greed, Power, and Endless War. James, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.